This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Feminism in your ears. It's another broad podcast on Joy 94.9. Keep listening. Hashtag feminism. Hashtag podcast. Hashtag broad. On Joy 94.9.
This podcast is presented to you by Broad on Joy 94.9 at the Melbourne Feminist Writers Festival. Broad presents Decommodifying Feminism.
Hi everyone, welcome. I'll try and start pretty much now on time so that we get plenty of time for discussion with these panels, because as you've probably noticed, they're all very tight in time, and this is a really meaty topic, and I hope we get a chance to actually get a bit more sort of discussion going with it. The Twitter hashtag is FWF16. I don't think we'll have a problem with this room, but zero policy on any kind of hate speech or aggression or anything, but I'm not sure we'll really head into that area here. I'll ask some questions of the panel in the beginning, and we'll have a good bit of discussion between the three of us, but I've definitely got plenty of time factored in for discussion together. All right. So I'll introduce myself. I'm Andy Fox. I'm a feminist economist by trade, but I have ended up writing a lot in maternal feminism and also sort of personal memoir writing. I write for daily life quite a lot. So you might have seen me when I was on the other panel with the other daily life writers. It's been a huge pleasure to bring together this panel when I saw it coming together. It's definitely an area that I write and think about a lot, particularly as a feminist. And it was really lovely to bring these two really big brains together for you. Petra and Viv are both, they've not met each other before either, so it's going to be interesting to see them a little discussing. But they're both very big, stimulating thinkers. So I knew we were going to get a good panel together with this. Viv has a very long history in internet feminism, which I'm going to ask her a bit about soon in the panel. So she brings a lovely context to the recent trends or characteristics that we see happening in feminism now, because Viv watched it all sort of unroll over the last 15 years or so. I'm going to get them both to introduce themselves in terms of qualifications, but Petra and I have both written and presented on liberalism and parenting, wasn't it? So we've both got a very strong interest in the intersection of economics with feminism, mm-hmm. and it's fairly unhealthy at times relationship, although it's also obviously been... there's no doubt about it that the biggest gains that have happened in feminism have happened alongside with capitalism. They dance together with it. But it has not always been a very healthy outcome. All right, so I'll get you both to introduce yourselves, and I think we'll sort of launch into questions. So, Viv, if you could give us a little bit of a background of where you were.
I'm a lapsed physiotherapist, which I stopped doing when my neck decided to remind me that I'd been in a car crash 20 years earlier and that I should really stop lifting heavy people. So I don't do that anymore. But I've also trained as an actor and done stand-up comedy, which is the best and the worst. And basically anything where I get to shoot my mouth off really is quite attractive to me, which probably got me arguing on the internet in the old-fashioned way back in the 90s, before I started blogging in 2005. And since then I've worked with a really interesting mix of women online, various blogging collectives. I've been tech support for Feminist, for the Geek Feminism blog, for the Feminist with Disabilities blog, and also for anyone who was interested in... the sort of Auspol, hashtag Auspol. Back in the day, I was tech support for Levadas Pradeo, the big purple blog, which is sadly no more, but it was very, very active. It was one of those blogs where discussions would go on for hundreds and hundreds of comments and various things. So there's been... I'm a very keen observer of various human foibles and system failures and the way they interact and exacerbate each other very often. And there we go.
Hi, everybody. My background is in sociology and psychotherapy, so I've been in academia doing a PhD for a long time, teaching and lecturing, so at Melbourne Uni, at Deakin Uni, and most recently at ACAP. I'm also a psychotherapist, and a couple of years ago I started writing feminist opinion pieces. I've probably been talking at the dinner table for 20 years with friends writing feminist opinion pieces, but I started putting that into practice, so in Online Opinion and more recently in New Matilda and in The Conversation. And at the moment I'm working on a book based on my PhD thesis on motherhood and what I call The Sexual Contract, following Carol Pateman. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I'm interested in that intersection of motherhood, neoliberalism, and kind of maternal feminism.
Can everyone hear us?
Okay, good.
I thought we'd start with a comment on the incredible popularity of feminism that we've seen in recent years. It's definitely lost a lot of its stigma. Viv, would you like to comment on that?
Well, yes and no. I think in the mainstream, it's lost a lot of the stigma, but on the margins, sort of anti-feminist opposition has hardened and become even more vocal and found, sort of ways to mass together to express their disgust at women with opinions. And so it's... like a lot of things, it's a two-edged sword. But on the other hand, I think there's a lot of... I'm very proud that my nieces know a lot more about my feminist blogging than my sister or my brother or any of my other sisters. My nieces know all about it. That's great. I love that. And they're all sort of happy to call themselves feminists, and their sort of friends are part of it. So... yeah, I think it is going in the right direction, but there's still a lot of reaction against it that can be devastating in some places, in some instances.
Yeah, I would echo what Viv has said there. I think it's really popular in certain milieu, like in educated, urban areas. But my sense is there's still, and in many respects it's commensurate with the rise of feminism, quite strong and vitriolic backlash. So I think it's this sort of dual tendency. So as women have become more empowered, I know that's a fraught term with lots of neoliberal associations, but as they have, I think the move, and it's more at a cultural level than a structural one, but I mean, you see it in the comments threads and you see it in the kind of threats to feminism. So I think it's a dual kind of process.
Oh, yeah.
And they have a relationship with each other. They're inextricably linked in a sense.
Certainly for some of the most vociferous anti-feminist voices, it's very performative for their own social circle rather than really personally directed. It's very much part of how they stake out being one of their club, being one of the boys, and, on the internet, they might park your bike and your motorcycle jacket are photoshopped, but they can definitely see that nasty tweet you sent somebody. So,
what role do you think likability has played in internet feminism?
Oh, well, I think it's played a lot in terms of which internet feminists have gone on to find wider voices in the sort of corporate media. Hugely, but some of people's favourite feminist bloggers are definitely also the Take No Prisoners ones, who are not necessarily very likeable at all, and who are quite proud of that, and that's part of their market difference, and they're probably never going to get a... Twisty Faster is never going to get a corporate media gig, for those who know who she is. so it's... I think it ties definitely into the commodification aspect and performative femininity generally. The more likeable you are, the more likely you are to be given a seat at the table.
Yes, that's right. Mm. I was thinking particularly of the rise in popularity of pop cultural analysis, feminist sites, which do some amazing analysis, but they definitely badge themselves as fun or funny or sexy or young or likeable. Yeah.
Yep. There's a lot of that, and I think too there's the distraction in a way of focusing so much on media literacy in terms of gender analysis and well, intersectional social oppression analysis generally. But I think I'm trying to remember who wrote it, and now I can't. But it was something. I think we're saying if we change the culture, the media will follow and be what we want. But if we change the media, the reverse will not necessarily occur.
That's interesting.
Which I thought was a very, very
very interesting comment. So I was going to ask you, how do you think feminist discussion has changed online as we've moved away from blogging as the dominant form of how that discussion happens?
Well, I think it's become very atomized and somewhat ghettoized and taking place in a lot of different social media corners. You know, a lot of people who used to have blogs now only do their opinionating on Facebook with a very curated friends list, and a lot of that is because they've been burnt by their blogging experiences for one reason or another, and it's very much self-protection. But it does limit the number of places where a more community-based personal voice is heard compared to the commissioned think piece. And I think that's a shame. But at least part of it is because of the very corporate level changes that have been made to the way people interact online. You know, when blogging started, you know, it's this sort of this very clunky thing on Google Blogs, or you know, or if you had the technical chops, you actually, you know, wrote your own code and had something very basic looking. But it was very much more under control, and you know, Google used to have a special search engine tabs for blogs. So if you wanted to go and look at what bloggers were saying about something, you went to the blogs tab. And they disappeared that, I think, in about 2009. They just decided that wasn't needed anymore, which was around about the time they rolled out Google Plus and wanted everybody to be interacting together there in a way that they could more effectively monetize for advertising and gather more data about you and all that sort of thing. Facebook's the same. Twitter less so. Twitter, you know, there's only so much that Twitter can find out about you from the way you interact. They can find out a lot from what you say, but from the different ways you interact otherwise, not so much. But it's just not as freewheeling as it used to be, and it's not as easy to discover people outside your own circles, particularly if they're avoiding the whole hashtag clickbait thing, which many people are. I mean, I have sort of know of quite a few secret groups on Facebook that just sort of invite friends of friends and everything else so that you can have your conversations without, you know, without Uncle Joe suddenly seeing that you're talking about something that he wishes none of you are talking about, and butting in. Which is definitely an experience I've had.
I want to make a comment.
Please, I was going on.
No, that's right. This is your field. But in terms of the popularity, you were talking about the popularity of feminists, and my sense is that, I think someone mentioned it in the last panel, but that feminists saying things to be torn down is also, I think you were saying about Andy, about commissioned pieces to tear others down and then they're happy for you to write that and then be lost in the fire of comments. Mm. My sense is, sure, there are cultural moments that made certain subjects more appealing than others, and cultural meanings and ideologies. So domestic violence is currently an issue that there's a sort of flashpoint or a lightning rod around, and everyone's talking about that. And then you get a number of feminists who talk about that, but it's not only that they're popular or well-liked or what they've got to say is acceptable. I think it's actually really fraught that they also end up being these figures of hatred too.
Oh.
And figureheads for representing feminism as this two-dimensional force, man haters and stereotypes. So the media sets up the really popular feminists to be in, I think, a highly dualistic and contentious position where they're simultaneously popular, loved and adored, and hated viciously. I mean, in a way that I find quite terrifying. I know Clementine said she's gotten used to it now, but I would find those kind of threats of rape and violence really
and
quite
Clementine
hideous.
Ford even more so than Clementine Basto. It's
much more.
You know,
yeah,
it's, she's sort of an absolute lightning rod.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
For,
but it's interesting how the culture at large, I think, I mean, I'm thinking here more like a sociologist, but make decisions about what topics are important, and then certain feminists come. It's not simply, I think, that they have cult of personality.
At the same time, as these changes have been happening, we've seen the whole Lean In movement happen, which was an incredibly mainstream moment in feminism. Would you like to make a comment on it and its place, Petra?
Sure. Yeah, I guess, I mean, my response to that when we thought about that question is, I think it's interesting the way, you know, the Sandbergs and what's the other one, Anne-Marie Slaughter wrote that article. They become these bastions in a way that Naomi Wolf was, you know, in the 90s for my generation of feminists then, for, you know, a particular kind of feminism that's mainstream and acceptable and held up as the norm we should aspire to. But I agree, they're exceptional. They're exceptional. What they're promoting is exceptional in the way that a model is. And it's, I mean, I think what's interesting in that sense is that the media runs with a Sandberg or a Slaughter, who I think is a professor at Princeton and resigned from a senior executive position to say she was having a more relaxed life as a full professor. she wouldn't simultaneously be in the Clinton administration or the Obama administration, rather. But my sense is that it sets up something that is actually the opposite or the inverse of the truth, which is to say that that is by no means the norm, but it's called the norm. It's the opposite of what is the truth, the norm that is held up to us.
Yeah.
And I think the other side of that, of course, is that it promulgates the neoliberal lie that women can be self-sufficient autonomous agents, as if social structure is irrelevant.
Well, the whole romance of individualism that underlies so much of neoliberalism. Here's your bootstraps, lift yourself up by them.
Women can be these autonomous agents, and what they happen to be doing in their private lives is you know, an irrelevant fact, when in fact it's what defines most women's lives. Certainly after the age of, you know, what's the statistical average, 30? just bringing in, you know, the motherhood issue. So once women become mothers, their capacity to be autonomous, entirely self-sufficient neoliberal subjects is compromised.
Yeah.
And the Slaughters and the... I mean, they're raising the issue of contradiction. They're raising the issue of work-life imbalance, but they're not raising the issue of the impossibility of the subjectivities they inhabit through privilege.
Yeah, about once a year I end up going on a Women in Leadership lunch somewhere, and it's always a beautiful lunch. But I find the tone of the discussion always incredibly frustrating, because it is always these extraordinarily exceptional women who come up and give speeches, and it's very much used as evidence that we've attained some level of equality, but also that the goals of equality will be more of us achieving lives just like theirs. There's no sense that there might be other goals you may have in life, or that they're actually incredibly exceptional and have been generally, and you can even hear it, the tones of it in the speeches, incredibly advantaged. I mean, they don't hide the advantages, but they've been incredibly advantaged usually on their path to it. And when I gave a plenary speech with Petra, I presented some economic analysis that I obtained from a professor in economics who I really, really like, and we talked about the data before, and he said, I said, well, haven't you published? And he said, oh, I won't publish it, it's just too controversial. And I said, well, I'll talk about it. And the data showed that you are no more likely to work full-time through your late 20s, 30s, in our generation, your generations, than your mothers were, which is kind of, that's extraordinary, because the effort that has gone into increasing your labour market participation is incredible. Governments have thrown so much at it. We've seen a huge rise in education levels, we've seen a huge rise in availability of contraception, we've seen lots of effort put into changing attitudes in workplaces. We've even seen lots of effort put into changing attitudes in relationships. And I'm not saying they're all successful, obviously, but all the same, there's been no change at all over those decades, which is incredible. And it's what it means we've plateaued in terms of gender income growth. And for the remaining future, it's difficult to see us ever coming out. What I find extraordinary then is that we would continue to push this idea that it's these exceptional women that is the path forward. This is how we are going to change things, this is how we will get greater equality or fairness in our community, in the economy. It's clearly not going to happen that way. Did you want to say something, Petra, about that idea that we will find, somehow we will find equality through all of us just working more and living life cycles more like men's.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've got lots of thoughts on that. But I'm thinking about a book I read 20 years ago, which was fundamental in some ways to my own consciousness raising around these issues. I'd lived it because I became a single mum in my very early 20s, and that put me on the path to studying and analysing motherhood, because I suddenly had a radical loss of freedom, a greatly reduced income, and, you know, it changed my life fundamentally relative to my peers. But a book that I read in, I think, 96, 97, called The Double Life of the Family, introduced that idea that we've got a myth of equality, that nowadays men and women are equal in work and equal in the home. Men are caring for children and women are going out to work. And they used a term that they borrowed from psychiatry around schizophrenia, and that was pseudo-mutuality. And I've never stopped using that term. I found it absolutely fundamental from Gregory Bateson's work, that there is this a lot of emotion work and a lot of sociological work put into the pretense of equality. And in fact, they found with some couples in their interviews, there was some more effort put into sustaining the myth of equality than actually living it. And I think that's a very fundamental kind of schizophrenic, so that psychiatric word, term that defines our culture. So we're very busy saying that we're equal. We're very busy saying that we're equal with our partners, with men, with our peers, when actually what we find is that once women have the responsibility of children, once they become mothers, that equality is torn asunder. Mm. And so I'm ambivalent, because I at the same time, I think I'm critical of the Sandbergs and the Slaughters and so on. I'd hate to say we don't admire or respect women's achievement in the public sphere. I'm thrilled that there's Hillary Clinton's, and that, you know, Julia Gillard was our first PM, and all. I'm thrilled, even though they lead different lives to me. They haven't had children often, or they've had one, and a lot of support.
And that's been one of my concerns about the criticism.
Me too.
Of that kind of liberal feminism, which is rife for criticism, but their end goal is the same as mine or ours. It's just that, and you're not born with full perspective.
No.
I mean, perspective evolves. Your understanding of how injustice or inequality or oppression operates, it evolves. You're not born with it. So I kind of think at least they're heading in a similar end goal of equality. Viv, did you want to say something about this topic?
Oh, look, just a thought going back to what you were saying about the pseudo-mutuality and the family equality and things. I'm just thinking, and it's an observation that's been made many times, but men in particular seem to keep getting surprised by it. The men who talk about looking after their own children as babysitting.
And help.
Yes. And which is extraordinarily common and very, very rarely called out. And if you do call it out, oh, the looks.
Yeah, yeah. And often, though, sadly,
he's doing so well. Can't you just let him enjoy it?
But I think what's troubling about that is it's often true. That yeah. he is merely the helper, and then what's mm. going on there, so that the relationships get set up very early on, mm. you know, in terms of that. And that's complex too, because when you factor in preferences, and I know that they don't exist in vacuums, but, you know, mm. a lot of the preference research shows women want to spend time with their kids. I mean, you talked about that, Andy, in the panel, mm. maternal desire. I mean, that. So it gets it's a
well,
very...
Well, yes, it interplays with gatekeeping issues
yeah,
as well.
Yeah, it's a yeah. very, very... And pleasure and desire in mm. actually being a mother. You know, and that's really difficult to talk about in feminist spaces too.
Mm. One of the things I wanted to mention before we start opening it up to the group is that the direction that we've clearly taken towards very commodified feminism, and I think, mm-hmm. Viv, it'd be fair to say that we saw signs of this quite a while back when with American feminism. When you're engaging mm-hmm. with American feminists... except for the most radical American feminists, it was just taken as a given that the marketplace had some kind of authority that you couldn't really question, I often found
yeah.
in discussions.
Like yes.
It was extraordinary to consider pushing anything beyond maternity leave, for instance. Paid maternity leave was a pretty radical goal. You couldn't really expect the workplace to accommodate any more than that.
Mm. Oh, I know, you know, sort of a you know, a lounge room set aside for pumping mothers?
That's right.
Dreaming. And, you know, there's this sort of, what are you, a communist?
Yeah.
Sort of, I mean, and this was not necessarily what the American feminist bloggers themselves were saying, but it was often there in the comments that were sort of left on the discussion from sort of outside things, because I think at an individual level they were often very sympathetic to these goals, but it was not something they felt was a primary focus for their own activism or intellectual concentration or anything, because it just seemed so unattainable. And just on another side of commodification, I'll just slip this in briefly before we open up things. I read a very strong article on Medium last week by Flavia Zodan, who's a European feminist, and if you've ever heard the phrase, my feminism will be intersectional or it will be bullshit, she is the woman who wrote that phrase. And she's had a bit of a hard time the last few years and hasn't been writing so much and things. And she came sort of, got a bit more engaged online recently and discovered that there's a whole heap of people out there selling tote bags and T-shirts mm-hmm. with that phrase on it. And 99% of them credit her as the author, but none of them are giving her 5%. Yeah, and these are people with Etsy shops and cafe press and things like this. It's not a major thing, but this it's not a major corporate endeavour, but it is a bit of an ethics situation of commodifying someone else's thoughts and not even telling them that you're doing it, let alone saying, obviously, you should get... you know, you should get some royalties. And so that's another aspect of the fragmentation of feminism in some ways, is that there are obviously people out there who've never even thought that that's anything but okay to put those words on a T-shirt and a tote bag and not do anything for the author.
Yeah, that's right. That's a good point. I was going to just... I didn't get a chance to ask you guys about the question, but it might come up more as a floor discussion. But where we see the dominance of this very capitalist-friendly form of feminism, where does that leave caregiving, as we've been speaking, but also community building or structural poverty? I mean, there's no grasp of structural poverty whatsoever in there. And or radical feminism or angry feminism.
Very little.
I think... the other aspect that I think you probably went through a very similar thing, Viv, or maybe you may have been way ahead of me on this one, but this is where I found... this is how I really... when I had a little baby, which is how I sort of really started getting into internet feminism once I had a baby, so that was 11 years ago, I started really... very soon after I wasn't finding the kind of feminism I wanted, I very soon ended up in American black feminism, which was far more
I found it far more dynamic about motherhood, because motherhood was viewed as a creative art, not just a disadvantage holding you back from getting back to work. But it was, I mean, they've also been much more further progressing, of course, for obvious reasons, taking into account things like structural poverty.
Oh, yes, and I think this is actually one of the things my involvement with Feminist came about, because Jill, despite being the epitome of a white liberal feminist herself, was very keen on getting voices from diverse areas to come and be guest bloggers and do all these things, and so then you'd follow what they were writing elsewhere when And I sort of certainly learnt a lot from some womanist writers and things about re-engaging perhaps with more some more radical, as you say, structural poverty and workers' rights aspects of the lived experience, which a lot of the other more high-profile bloggers were not engaging with, because they were, a lot of them, you know, sort of feminist and things. These were blogs that were started when the people were at college, you know, and everything else, and doing a whole different thing and knowing that they were going on to a professional career. So it's a very different background to be blogging from.
Yes, that's right. The justice system wasn't there. Thank you.
I think I was just going to comment on that, with tying into the earlier question, that in some ways, and I think you may have already mentioned it, Andy, but that it's defined by useful agendas, often because the women who started a lot of these blogs or who became the high-profile feminists were themselves in their 20s or now they're sort of just in their early 30s. And so, I mean, I think it'll be interesting to see how that evolves and changes, but for many of us who were already interested in motherhood studies or feminism or mothering, that was missing from the discourse. And older women too, as you've mentioned, Andy, like I was thinking about Jermaine Greer's response to the group Femin, who do the nude protest, but happen to at the same time, you know, fit norms of beauty in the West. And she said, what would really be radical is to be seeing old women doing nude protests. This is not radical. These women just look like gorgeous 25-year-olds. Excuse me. And so, again, you sort of, the agenda of a lot of this popular feminism is defined by useful interests, and rarely is it defined by some of these concerns that, you know, we're bringing to the table here, like maternal feminism and older women and structural poverty and the kind of impact of long-term, you know, earning lower wages, lower superannuation. They seem like dry and boring subjects, but they're actually very fundamental to women's equality and inequality.
Absolutely.
All right, we might go to questions or comments.
It's kind of more of a comment, I guess, but going back to what you were saying at the beginning about decodifying feminism, but like, and of the investments that have been made in putting women in various positions, maybe how do we change the conversation around, like, how do we stop throwing money at a problem? How do we stop throwing money at inequality and expecting it to be fixed?
And you're talking about equality via the root of the workplace? Or
Not really, I guess.
So your question was, how do we stop throwing money at the problem?
Yeah, how do we stop throwing money at, like, structural inequality?
I actually think, as an economist, I actually think we are heading probably in a direction that will force us to address some of these issues, because they're going to be no longer sustainable. Mm-hmm. I'm a born optimist, but I really do think the discussion is heading is really heading toward, and we've seen, you know, between the time when I first started my first degree in economics and where we are now, it's a very left-wing economics dominates economic thought, and it dominates it because it's refuted now the theories of so much of the right, and the data has borne that out. So I think the idea that inequality is sustainable, or that a country is in the end productive out of being so unequal, is now clearly starting to be questioned very, very broadly. So you have, so I think we are some of these areas, and again, I would say the same thing about diversity. The thing that will push diversity will be, it won't just be people finally catching up on the ethics. It will be that diversity works better than the other model. That if you have diverse decision makers in power, you will do better, you will come up with better decisions, better ideas, better innovations, better partnerships than the other model. And so I think some of this stuff will be forced along the way.
As an example of that, I have to say I think that orchestras today are far more interesting than they were 30 years ago since blind auditions were introduced. Wow. And all of a sudden they discovered that actually, yes, so many women could play more than just the flute or the violin or the harp just as well as a man could, you know, when they couldn't see them. And so now we look at an orchestra and so many of them are, you know, approaching gender parity. We have so many more female conductors and things. And I think it makes a very different dynamic in the theatre to what it was when it was just a sea of tuxedos up on the stage. And I think that's an extrapolatable model.
Yeah, very good point. Another question or comment? Is it?
Yes. I just wanted to kind of go back to why, as feminists, maybe we want to be against capitalism or capitalism as an idea. And for me, it's a bit about the fact that capitalism exploits bodies, and it still does that for women in, you know, developing countries who might have, you know, for example, stitched the tote bag together that says, you know, my feminist intersectional. And kind of also picking up on your point, Andy, about the pitching of feminism or equality to big corporations as like, it'll be better, you'll make better decisions because the bottom line will be better, because that's kind of what it comes down to. And for me, that doesn't quite sit right with the view that I have, which is that, yeah, being a feminist doesn't fit well within this capitalist dogma, because it's always going to be about the exploitation of someone, usually people that are vulnerable, often the most vulnerable people are women. Women of colour, you know, LGBTI women, LGBTI people. So I just wanted a bit more discussion about that.
Do you want me to lead on this one and then throw it to you guys? Or?
I'm happy to answer that, or at least the first part of that, or the response. I think that feminism in its radical form, and by that I kind of include socialism rather than the pure definition of radical feminism, is incompatible with capitalism. And that what Andy's saying before about these problems are going to be forced, we're going to have to be solving them because there is a whole generation of older women now that just cannot afford the cost of living and are, you know, filling up the ranks of the homeless now, and issues like that, these so-called wicked problems that we're facing, environmental crisis, so that without some kind of response to capitalism and what it's doing to the planet and to marginalised people, we're in trouble. And I think one fundamental answer that we were going to touch on but haven't had a chance to yet is basic income as a way of, universal basic income,
yes,
as a way of distributing the wealth that is increasingly concentrated. And I watched, as part of my preparation for a talk at the panel on neoliberalism and mothering, I watched a video by the Greek finance minister Yanis Varoufakis. I don't know, he's fabulous. And he says capitalism died in 2008 and was replaced with bankruptocracy. And that fundamentally we now live in a corrupt system defined by financialisation and no respect for the planet, and that it has to change, and recirculating the wealth is one way we can have a more feminist and more egalitarian answer to that. I don't know, I think I'm touching on that, you know, very generally and generically. But I mean, feminists have often talked about the unhappy marriage between Marxism and feminism, but I think there's a very happy marriage between capitalism and patriarchy, and a divorce is in order.
Does that answer your question sufficiently?
I don't think it was a question.
Yeah.
I wanted to hear your thoughts on it. I feel like that's at the crux of that question about the
I mean, I think that the difficulty is that, like I said in the introduction, the most significant feminist gains in terms of equality happened because women were able to get control of their own resources. And that obviously happened very happily with capitalism. In the end, it actually exacerbated inequality because, as you probably know, women who earn higher incomes are more likely to partner up with men who earn higher incomes, and the converse. And so what you see is particular households jumped up by a huge amount and the other ones didn't. And yet everybody lost their home care work that they were all getting for free, or men were getting for free in their households. But one lot went by, achieved a huge income growth at the same time. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that pulled us apart.
Yeah.
Another comment? Or? Yes.
How do we address the use of feminism and empowerment by those who are, you know, trying to actually actively keep it down? I'm talking about Karl Lagerfeld doing an empowerment catwalk show, you know, even to a certain extent, you know, Beyonce with feminism up behind her, when they're not, you know, it seems to be quite a buzzword at the moment to speak about women's empowerment, to speak about feminism as a force for good, and to use it to sell products. I mean, Dove's been doing this for 10 years.
Yeah.
Without actually enacting any social change, you know, to build up underneath, underneath using it as a sales tactic.
Yeah. Viv, can you handle this part?
Oh, goodness. I'm not sure exactly how to go about it. I think, you know, perhaps something along the order of the old bugger up activists who used to scrawl things on billboards back in the 80s when they sort of found them, you know, too nakedly greed sort of worshipping. You know, sort of perhaps getting some more iterations of that as street activism might help stop some of these sort of campaigns seeming so attractive to the people who are very keen on them at the moment. Much like I know there are some terrific women going around with spray cans in their purses for just in case they see a wicked van, and you know just spraying over whatever is the worst of it. And I think, you know, sort of you, I think sometimes there has to be a certain level of that gut level, visceral, you know, public resistance approach in order to have any effect. But it's, you know, it's hard because, you know, it's so easy to go home and anaesthetize yourself by binge watching something, you know, instead of thinking about what's enraged you that day. It's your comfort food. It's a way to try and put that out of your head, because otherwise it's too hard. So I don't know how to find the balance and things, but I think trying to encourage people to engage in some more active programs of civil resistance and everything else. And, you know, the power it had in India is just sort of back in, you know, sort of in the 1940s. It's sort of tens of thousands of people standing strong and refusing to be moved. There's a lot of power in that, but it's very hard to build yourself up to do it. But I think it's the sort of thing that eventually is going to have to happen.
It reminds me when Bell Hooks was talking about Sheryl Sandberg, and she was saying that how incredibly seductive personal anecdotes are in terms of selling that propaganda, I guess. And to a degree, that's sort of what you see in some of that brand stuff, that kind of that little element of personality that's in there when it's incorporated within a woman, kind of giving a personal disclosure or a confession about how this experience is for her and how Dove's made it feel better. It is very seductive. I think that overall the growing kind of discontent that people are feeling with a sort of endless pursuit of wealth, maybe this will be part of what makes people turn away from it.
Well, we can, but hope.
Yes, right.
I think there are unfortunately always people who look at the true oligarchs who've been, you know, who've had generations and generations of dynastic wealth and think, I want me some of that, and they're working very hard to join their ranks. And not really caring, you know, whether they underpay their workers on the way or what they do. And that's a hard thing to combat, particularly in the face of, say, judicial decisions in the US, like Citizens United, which just opened the floodgates of corporate money in electoral campaigns in an utterly unprecedented way. I mean, it had always been pretty bad, but now they've, with super PACs and everything else, they have literally billions to throw at elections that they never had before because of that one decision by the Supreme Court. So it's, I don't know, there's just so many little ways that the corporatocracy and the oligarchy is, and the patriarchy is nibbling at the edges of things that used to be more part of our commons. Mm. And they do it in such little bits at a time that it's hard to catch them at it until it's a done deal. And that's the thing, I think, to educate people about a bit more and try and work harder against.
That's a very good point. At the same time, I think David Peets, who's also a really lovely economist on the left, has written a really good paper that refutes the idea that we've moved completely towards individualism in Australia. And he actually found that a lot of data, there's evidence of Australia maintaining very strong beliefs and commitment to collectivist approaches. In terms of, you know, surveys that ask them, is this, you know, government's role or is this an individual role? And also looking at levels of volunteerism and things like that, and has found quite sustained evidence that Australia maintains a very collectivist approach, in spite of all.
I was going to have a response to your question there, which I think is a good one. To me, it's actually quite insidious, and again, the term neo-mutual comes to mind because, of course, it's exploiting a particular discourse of freedom, but ultimately to the ends of exploiting women's vulnerabilities. So around the beauty myth or around being inadequate in some way, needing this deodorant or shaver. Or so in actual fact, again, it's the inverse of the truth. So now feminism is used, of course, as you're saying, to as a commodified end or to a commodified end, but it's, you know, mutual because it's actually around women's constructed insecurities.
We've probably got time for two more questions if there are.
Going back to the idea of the commodification of feminism by a corporate, I feel like there's a bit of a smokescreen situation happening where corporates are taking it on and saying, we're great, we've got all this diversity and inclusion, employer of choice. And I do think that pushing women through the ranks to become more visible in leadership will help. But like, I'm going to a session on unconscious bias next week that's being run by a white guy. And, you know, he's talking about how it impacted him. And I just feel like... I wrote back to say, I've got a conscious bias. And they said that I'm more qualified because he's been really into diversity and inclusion. So I think, you know, to borrow the schizophrenic language, it puts women in this real double bind. And even if you don't want to be the CEO, how do we make workplaces a more palatable place for women? Like, I come to these kind of places and it's really energising, and I find it a really great feminist space, but the feminist spaces I encounter in my workplace sometimes feel quite toxic, and I'd like to be able to kind of reclaim that, because again, I don't want to just pour hot cold water over it and say get rid of it all, because that's not the answer. It's just really hard to navigate as kind of an outlier, because as a single mother there are barriers in place to me ever getting into that managing director role or whatever. And I went to another women in leadership seminar, and the senior woman there said the answer was to have a really supportive partner and make sure you get lots of help. So
thanks.
I want to be a productive member of society, and like this, until the revolution comes, I've got to have a job. So how do you kind of make all of that? Like, how do you be a feminist at work when there's so many challenges there? That's a big question.
We're at time.
We just died, that's
how I feel. You had it.
Sorry.
I'll do a soundbite. And it's a cynical one. I'm sorry, but my sense is there isn't an easy answer. I was marginalised in the workplace as a single mum too. I don't think there's a solution to that, and I think that's really hard to live with. I mean, other than, yeah, revolution, like you said, until the revolution, but you're carrying that additional burden. I put that in quotes. You've got a child, you don't have a partner, you've got to go to work. I mean, one thing I think just immediately, pragmatically, is calling them up on having quotas. Well, that man shouldn't be in that job, and you could possibly anonymously say that, or in that role, rather. But I think there isn't a magic answer, unfortunately.
I would absolutely agree. I think one of the major things that can be done, at least at an interpersonal level, is trying to be a bit more proactive about networking with other women, in a mentorship way. You know, sort of mutual mentorship in terms of the skill sets and things you have, rather than trying to go it on your own and be super employee. And I think the more that happens, the more solidarity there is to endure some of the other slings and arrows in the workforce as well as everybody sort of gaining something concrete in terms of their job. So I think that's an important small thing to be done, but I think it can, over the long term, have some good results.
Well, as you know, I have spent time being a single parent as well. And recently, in my role as an economist, I was asked something about what government could do in terms of sort of data collection. And I said, I would really recommend you collect data not on how many women are in management, but how many women have children and are single parents in management, because that will tell you something about how friendly your workplace is.
Yeah.
I completely agree with you. No, there won't be very many. It'll be very, very poor.
Feminist dudes.
I just want to thank the audience. We'd love to thank the panel, Petra and Viv. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This has been a special broadcast from Broad at the Melbourne Feminist Writers Festival on Joy 94.9.
Thank you. You've been listening to a broadcast on Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.